faculty members and the director of the college's athletic department over a period of about 9 months. Much of the controversy centers around the fact that the report insists that the present sports program at the college must be changed, and the only changes the committee recommended were these. Policy 1, to downgrade athletics to the small college level, cutting support for varsity football and basketball, and making the role of sports more educational and recreational for the majority of students. Or Policy 2, to implement an extensive buildup of athletics, concentrating on the Big Two, football and basketball, and build a national sports reputation to match the college's national education reputation. The report denies the existence of any workable middle ground between the two extremes. Our guests on Information Point are Barry Frapkin, the Sports Promotions Director of the college, and Sharon Pandak, President of the William & Mary Student Association. The athletic department is not happy with the de-emphasis proposal. The student body at the college is not really happy with either alternative. The student association has even voted to endorse something of a third suggestion. Beginning with you, Barry, what is it that the athletic department considers undesirable about the de-emphasis program?
Well, probably, Brian, the word de-emphasis in itself. We have a program as it exists now that has brought some recognition to the college on a certain level, and a drop back in the program would be one that I don't think the people who have been traditionally attuned to William & Mary would be very happy with, from the standpoint of it is basically an elimination of an intercollegiate athletic program. In our thinking, when you talk about de-emphasis, you're talking about there is no funding under Proposal 1 for a football or basketball team. There is no funding for a football team. They mentioned dropping it for a three-year period until they can develop funds for it. And football, because it is the big item in the budget, seems to get all the attention. I don't want to address myself so much to football alone because, for example, track, which has been able to compete on a national level, one of excellence, would be de-emphasized, would not be in the form. We would have no scholarships, no recruiting under Proposal 1. And this, to us, is unrealistic to have any type of competitive situation.
Why, then, do you think that Proposal 2 would work? Taking, for example, the college as an educational institution primarily, don't you think that Proposal 2, with its emphasis on big-time athletics, might detract from its reputation to those people who traditionally are associated with the college for its educational aspect?
First of all, Brian, I don't think that Proposal 2 is big-time athletics. Proposal 2 is merely financially what we have right now, with a 5% increase projected for the next 3 years. The budget, as itemized in Proposal 2, is exactly the expenditures that we have currently during the 74-75 year, with a projected 5% inflation increase. Now, it does give the opportunity, if gate receipts and the Educational Foundation can generate additional funds, to improve the program. But certainly this is no way a big-time program.
Sharon, is it true that the Student Association does consider neither program desirable?
I think that's probably characteristic of most of the students at the college. What they feel was, immediately they looked at it, and there are a minority of people who feel that Program 1, Policy 1, is the best option. There are also a group of people who feel quite the opposite. But we, in many discussions that we've had over the past week or so, we've come to the conclusion that a compromise measure would probably be much more desirable as a practical measure in terms of the college's athletic policy. And some of the reasons why students were turned off by Policy 2, which I think made them opt for this compromise, rather than going to something which scared people off by saying de-emphasis, although I'm not sure that that term in itself is characteristic of Policy 1. I think there's a differentiation between Policy 1 and the program itself. So what the Senate, or representing the Student Association, has done has approved Policy 1 in its concept and has also added that financial aid should be given to students who have met the qualifications of the college and grants and aid, in particularly to emphasize basketball, while at the same time de-emphasizing football somewhat, at least for a period of time until the revenue that's accrued from basketball or from the continuing sports program as a whole is such that that revenue can be put into grants and aids for these other sports, which would include football, and to build up the program that way, instead of changing the student fee, which was voted against rather strongly last spring, and instead of charging the students a mandatory ticket book. And I think in that way the students feel that the standards of the college are upheld. At the same time, they have an opportunity to see intercollegiate games on a scale which is competitive. I think there's a thing that has to be clarified there. Competitive does not necessarily mean playing big name schools, even if not big time. And competitive essentially means being to play somebody in which you play well against that particular team, nor does it mean downgrading and playing a team which is particularly inferior.
Why the emphasis on basketball?
I think the students see Carey Field as being a rather limited facility, and they feel that we cannot accrue the type of revenue from football which would take care of that program financially. And they see William Mary Hall, quite the opposite, as being a facility which has yet to realize its potential in terms of spectators. And they also see the problem of grants and aids in itself, that is, funding a student to go through college to play an entertainment sport, as being minimized somewhat because there the number of grants and aids are significantly less in terms of the NCAA requirements. And therefore they would be minimizing what they feel to be a problem, but looking at it rather practically.
Barry, one of the reasons that the committee noted in support of Policy 1 was the problem with facilities. Assuming that Policy 2 were to be adopted, what sort of changes would be made in the athletic facilities at the college, if any? How would the program change other than more money being put into it?
We have a dichotomy in that Carey Field is not an adequate facility on the level that even Southern Conference football, I would say Carey Field is probably the poorest facility in the conference, while William & Mary Hall may be, along with Richmond's Robbins Center, are the two finest on-campus facilities that anyone in our area has. So we have a very good and a very bad situation. However, getting back to the practical part of it, Carey Field is somewhat adequate for our needs right now and still can provide us with revenues capable of supporting the football program. Let me detail it a little bit. We play four home football games. Virginia Tech game this past week, we had a near sellout crowd. We came within a few hundred tickets of selling all the seats. It meant to us as much revenue as we would get in any game we've had this year, on the road or elsewhere, big stadium or small stadium. It meant to us maybe as much as $35,000 net to William & Mary athletic football program. So Carey Field can generate, if we have the crowd, enough revenue to support a football program. Last year, gate receipts were up enough that we had a $31,000 surplus in the football program over what was projected as revenue. Now, I'm not saying that gave us a profit in football, because you have to take into consideration that student fees are part of revenue. And if you take student fees out of our revenue, then nothing makes a profit. But what I'm saying is that what was projected for football gate receipts, that was $31,000 additional dollars because we had a good year at the gate.
I'd like to respond to that. I think one thing that the report points out on its first page is that there was a deficit in the football program which necessitated taking some funds from general current fund local, which heretofore has not been touched. I think the reason for the report is cited in the first several pages and is clarified by the Board of Visitors, was that we don't have a financially stable program at this point, and I think Mr. Fracken will admit that. The second point I'd like to make in terms of the facilities is, as he's given you impression, we are now operating at essentially capacity in terms of Carey Field, which would mean in terms of projecting budget increases of revenue and gate receipts to that field, you really can't project a whole lot more unless you do not save those seats for students, which under a mandatory ticket book I have been assured would be saved, unless you begin to sell those seats, because all of the students do not attend the games, and then increase the revenue in that way. And there I see it as being a basic unfairness to the student who has to pay for this ticket book. The other problem that I see in terms of facilities are, in order to generate more revenue given this situation, then therefore we're going to have to play teams away who have larger stadiums. And if it means that our best games will be played away for this specific reason, then in a sense you aren't satisfying that area of the community which wants to see a good game of football played at a home field. And I think that presents a real problem there in terms of meeting the type of goals that Policy 2 projects.
I think that's a good point, that the facility keeps us from playing some of the better teams. For example, Virginia Tech next year, we played in the Oyster Bowl, although it is their home game. We've moved the Virginia Tech game in the past to the Tobacco Bowl in Richmond to generate more revenue. But you're wrong, Sharon, in the fact that we are near the potential of Cary Field. One game out of four does not mean that we have reached that potential. Cary Field still represents, if we were to fill Cary Field to its capacity, the four times that we play there, as opposed to what we are doing right now over the last 2 years, which have been good years, we would have an increase of nearly $100,000 in football gate receipts from those home games, just those four home games. So we have a chance of a 50% increase. We're talking about $205,000 next year in football gate receipts. If we were to sell out Cary Field all four times that we play, it would mean an additional $100,000 in home gate receipts over what we would have this year. Now, that is a substantial increase. Now, I'm not saying it's possible, but it is true figures.
My only response is I find those numbers a little bit...
Okay, let's break them down. Okay, let's break them down. I'll give you some numbers then and explain it to you. For the total gate for the Citadel game was $30,000. That was not a bad crowd for us. We've had worse. For example, we had a game the year before that was only $21,000. Okay? So let's take maybe $25,000 as an average.
What is the number of people that were there that brought this $30,000 in? I think that's fairly crucial.
The number of people?
The price per seat and the number of people in the stadium.
Right. The number of paid attendants... for which game?
Citadel one that you're referring to.
Citadel game would be in the neighborhood of, now are we talking about students?
No, I'm talking about paid seats.
Paid seats, okay.
Plus, I assume you're including that those reserved seats are for students, and therefore, you know, it would be over and above those particular seats, which will always be maintained.
Right.
As seats
we're talking students. About 4,000, 5,000, close to 5,000 paid. When you add, what I'm talking about is, let's say we have 5,000 people paid at a game, and you have 4,000 seats that you save for the students. That's 9,000 seats with 6,000 remaining. And just take an average of $5 per seat, taking the average of a sideline seat versus an end zone seat, and average it out at $5 a seat, times those 6,000 additional seats that are available to sell in a capacity of 15,000. That's $30,000 a game times four games is $120,000. Is my arithmetic all right?
Considering the trouble I have balancing a checkbook, I won't challenge you on that. Well, let me ask something to Sharon, though. As president of the Student Association, have you noticed a certain dissatisfaction among the student body that they do have to pay out a substantial amount of money each year in athletic fees, and for the most part do not get to participate in the sports for which they pay, either by playing or by viewing?
I think that came out quite clearly last spring in the BSA vote, which, as you mentioned before, was one of the reasons that the survey was set up, that the report was made. And I think it became very clear there that the students did not want the fee increased. What's become apparent to me over the past month or so since this has come out into the open is that there are a lot of students who are definitely concerned that they are not getting their money's worth from the fee. And I don't think this is something that's just developed in the initial month or so since the report has come out or within that time period, but something that's been existing for a number of years. And that those people, justly so, who feel that they cannot participate in a sport or that they have no desire to, have to subsidize that program. And I think there's a basic unfairness there.
I think that when we talk about participation is one aspect of the student fee. I don't have figures of participation in the athletic program. But I think participation, and one of the members on the committee made this point at one of the meetings that I was there back in April, that participation is also a spectator at a football game. And I think that we're talking about this. Now, just as some, I can go back when I was a student at William & Mary and we paid a fee. We didn't know what it was. But we knew that that fee was an admission fee to all athletic events. Anytime the athletic department tried to charge for an athletic event, we were up in arms over the fact that we got in free as students. And I think that this is a large part of the fee, that it is the opportunity to see intercollegiate athletics. Now, obviously, everyone cannot participate in intercollegiate or intramural athletics, and part of it is for the student. Now, you know, we save 3,500 seats at a football game, and they are...
Are there not more students than that in the student body?
There are something like 4,200. Now, we have, as we save 3,500 because that is what the demand has been somewhat. On some games, like this Virginia Tech game or the East Carolina game is one that I most vividly recall 2 years ago, there were people sitting in the aisles. There just was a solid wall in that sideline section of people, of students in that section. And it is obvious to us that students, you know, are filling up those seats. If it becomes to the point that every student comes to a game, which is, you know, would really be unusual at any school in the country, then we would reserve more seats. We reserve 3,500 because that is pretty much what the demand is. When you get to other places like the University of Virginia, they reserve 4,400 seats for their students of a student body of 12,000 for basketball, and sell 4,000 season tickets at $40 each. Now, this is the potential you were talking about in basketball that William & Mary could go to. We have the opportunity at William & Mary to reserve a seat for every student and still sell 5,000 or 6,000 seats.
There's a number of points I'd like to bring up in reference to that. If you feel that there's a broad, wide attendance of students at present and that, you know, the type of program that you're mandating for the future is something that's going to definitely attract students, then I really can't first see the point in having a season ticket book, which is mandatory. It appears to me that if the interest is there and a person wants to see the game, then they should have a right to see that game, and they should be able to pay for it with, you know, the funds from their own funds. But I cannot see the student body as a whole having to pay if they have no interest in those particular sports. Another thing I'd like to turn to is that breakdown of the fee.
Sharon, let me answer just that point, if that's all right with you, in that I agree with you wholeheartedly that, you know, students should have that option. And as part of Proposal 2, they are asking that it be mandatory for a certain amount, a transitional period, to the point that this football and basketball can generate enough revenue so that it can be an optional situation. But I think that to drastically go to a different program the next year without giving the program a chance to make it on its own would be too unfair a burden at the beginning. But the idea and the concept of an optional ticket, I think, is the only ethical one to approach. But it would need a 3 or 4 year transitional period to let football and basketball get on its feet and sustain itself and absorb some of that student fee.
Okay, before referring to that fee, in reference to that, the report does not say that after 3 years that the fee will be cut out. It says, and I'd like to quote, the student ticket book may be eliminated. And I think if you notice, if you're looking at the report, that there is no allowance made if that student ticket book is eliminated to take up for that gap in the amount of revenue coming into the program. I also seem to hear very strongly as a advantage to Program 2, and the reason for having it is that the alumni have a stake in it, the alumni are willing to put up the money. If this is indeed true, and all we have to say as a college is, yes, you have the mandate, as long as you provide the money, we'll provide the program, then it seems to me that 3 years is an entirely too long of a period to let the alumni say, yes, we're going to increase the money. Now, some of the figures I've heard thrown around is $200,000 to $300,000 an increase in alumni funds. But if you'll notice the projected figures, and it's very hard, I think, for somebody who doesn't have the report right in front of them, is it goes from $125,000 next year, which is only a step up of $15,000, to $135,000 the following year, and then $145,000 that subsequent year of 1977-78, when the fee should be, when a ticket book should be eliminated. Another point I'd like to make, and this is from the student's point of view, that there's an immense amount of concern, is that total of student fee at $103 projected for next year does not indeed reflect the entire amount of money that the student will be paying. There are two things that are notably left out, one particularly important if Title IX goes through, and that's in reference to sexual discrimination. And even if it doesn't go through, I think most people will admit that the philosophy itself is a valid one. And you'll notice that in that fee is not included the $9 to $10 additional dollars for grants and aids to women. Another point that the report fails to mention is the fact that this fee, the $88, which in the past also included student concerts and social events, is also not included in that fee. So I think the fee would be up around the nature of $120 instead of $103. But if you look at that fee, you notice also that right now that women have to pay for grants and aids to men non-revenue sports, and still you have the student having to pay for another student's education, and that's something that the Student Association proposal particularly addresses, and they think that if grants and aids are to be provided, and practically they may have to be, that money should not come from student fees, that it should come from the Educational Foundation and the money that the alumni put into it, as in the past, except for the most recent year. And I think that's something that has to be made quite clear, that students don't feel that they ought to have to pay for someone else's education. We're paying enough money right now in terms of our own education, and if we have no interest in the sport, that even increases the unfairness of it.
Barry, what provision is the athletic department making for Title IX, or will it make if Proposal 2 is adopted?
Title IX is a very complex situation right now in that it's still in the interpretation process, and as Sharon mentioned, whether it appears in its final form as it may appear now, the theory of it and the is has to be accepted that there has to be, or there should be, is a better way of putting it, equal opportunity for women's athletics. There should be more money put into the women's program, and Proposal 2 nearly doubles the amount that they have. And but it, the hard part of saying what would the athletic department do in reference to Title IX is something that we would have to judge once we see what Title IX says as law, whether it's been postponed and postponed from interpretations, and it appears that it will not have its final interpretation until the spring now, and still has to be signed into law by the president. So there's the possibility that the revenue sports of football and basketball will be exempt from Title IX. And these are all possibilities, but certainly we recognize the fact that something should be done for equal opportunity in athletics. Now, whether it's going to be our responsibility, or it's the men's athletic department, or whether it's going to be the state's responsibility, or whether it's going to be the college's responsibility, is something that I think we just have to wait and see. Now, the Educational Foundation, of which I'm the executive director, went on record yesterday with the president to say that we are aware of the implications of Title IX, and when it appears in its final forms, we will be ready to act accordingly, which means that we will consider the problem and we will comply with what Title IX says. I don't know that we can do any more at this time.
Sharon?
Yes, it seems to me that whether or not Title IX comes out and the effects that it would very seriously have on this particular program, that even in looking at it, from my point of view as a woman, I'm completely turned off by the fact that here is a total of $79 out of that $103 going to men's sports, and only $19 provided for women. And in no way can I see that as being anywhere near comparable if I'd never even heard of Title IX. And I think that's what is a fear concern of many women on this campus, and also of a large number of men. And another thing I'd like to point out, and this is just a clarification of something that I happened to see in the news today, which I'd like to clarify, most definitely. I don't know whether one newspaper specified that there was a 60% vote of sorts taken, demonstrating that 60% of the students were against de-emphasis of athletics, particularly in reference to Policy 1. Now, I'd like to clarify at this point that although students have been making their voices known and that specific groups have taken votes, that there has been no campus referendum of any sort taken. And there hasn't been one taken in reference to any athletic questions for at least the past 2 years, and relating specifically to any of these programs, not since I've been at the college, so I really question where that information came out, and I'd like to clarify it.
Comments of both of you have raised a point I'd like to explore for a minute. There seems to be a basic difference in philosophy on the question of for whom the athletic program is to be. Is it for the students or the college as a whole? Is it for the alumni and the college community?
I think that this is, in essence, the difference in Policy 1 and Policy 2. As stated, our feeling, of course, on Policy 2 or Program 2 is that, and I'll quote from the report, is that the intercollegiate athletic program for men and women at William & Mary will be planned, developed, and administered for the benefit of the college community. Now, going to my own words here, you're talking about the athlete who participates, the townsperson who spectates, the alumnus who returns to the campus, the total college community, as it says. It is different things to different people. As an athlete, say Bill Deary, it may be a great deal of fun. As a townsperson, it may be entertainment. As an alumnus, it might be a source of pride. I think an intercollegiate athletic program is many things to many different people, and I think that's what policy statement number 2 tries to say, as opposed to policy statement number 1, which says that the program should be almost exclusively for the participant and his recreation.
I think that's where the Student Association and the Board of Student Affairs, which voted yesterday 14-1 in favor of Policy 1, but made no projection at all in terms of a decision on either program. And as from what I understand, the faculty have also voted in favor of Policy 1. They feel, and I think justly so, that the college should cater to the people who are intensely involved in it, and that being particularly the students and the faculty. Now, that's not to say that there shouldn't be given some concern to the interests of alumni. I think that we're lucky to have a very interested alumni, and I'm hoping that that would continue. But at the same time, I can't see a policy being formulated strictly for the entertainment of not only the alumni, but some other abstract group which may have nothing to do with the college. I think in a time period where you can watch intercollegiate football from the end of May until January, that there's ample provision made for those people who want to see big-time football played either intercollegiately or on a professional level on the television or in person. And I think the facilities are provided for those people. I don't see, and I think this reflects most of the students, why the college should have to provide something strictly for the entertainment of a much larger group of people who may or may not be concerned with the college community and the college's educational system. I think the important thing that they see, and it scares them off about policy too, is even though it doesn't say big time, in order to meet a lot of the needs that it specifies in catering to this college community, there's going to be increasingly amount of pressure in terms of finances, in terms of facilities, in terms of pressure on the student athlete as well on the coaches, which is not demonstrated in Policy 1, which can allow for a competitive-type athletic program, which will attract alumni. It will give them a chance to come back and see a good football game. I don't think there's any problem there. I don't think the students are against homecoming or that sort of thing, but it allows that for those people who are interested. At the same time, it places, first and foremost, as indeed the self-study did, which was compiled concerning the college a couple of years ago, that the college is first and foremost an educational institution. And I think that's something that really has to be kept in mind in determining a policy, which is what this committee was specifically slated to do for the future. Now, it may be that the program in itself will be a compromise within those two areas in order to cater to financial pressures of that, you know, or any other type of pressures that may arise with the larger community. But I think policy is something that's very important to be rather firm on. And I don't see policy, too, as really, in a sense, even being a policy. I think it's something that essentially says, well, athletics are for entertainment, and this is something you may or may not relate to the College of William & Mary, but it sets up that not in relationship at all to the particular institution.
Sharon, I need to comment on a few of those things. Mm-hmm. First of all, you make the reference that the alumni are not interested in the school. Yeah. They,
I'm sorry,
you
if
said,
I gave that impression.
Well,
I
wish I could remember the exact words, but they are intensely interested. There is a group of alumni, obviously not all 22,000 who have graduated or who have gone to this school and are out in the world, but when, say, for example, 50%, I believe this figure is correct, of the law school graduates contributed to the college, 50%. Is that right, Brian? Because you're in the law school.
Did they contribute particularly to athletics?
No, I'm not talking about athletics. I'm talking about to the school. You're talking about people who are interested in the school, intensely interested in the school. The alumni of this college, law alumni and the undergraduate alumni and the business school alumni, everyone, there is an intensely interested group of people who contribute important money. Now, whether it's large sums or not, or important money to the college itself, these people are intensely interested. When the College Development Office is making a very strong and active campaign to solicit money from local people who are not alumni because of the college's impact upon the community, the alumni and the townspeople are, there is a group, a large group, who are intensely interested. As high as 50%, say, of the law alumni, going on down to the 1,500 people who contribute to the Educational Foundation. This is an interested group in the activities of the College of William & Mary. And for example, there is an individual who gives both to the Educational Foundation and to the business school. He gives to the business school because he is in business. He thinks it's important that William & Mary turn out good business administration majors, but he says that his real tie to the college, his thing that keeps him involved in the college, is an athletic program, one that he is proud of, one that he is interested in, one that he derives a lot of his social life around. So this is that public expression that he is able to have that keeps him coming back to the college. Now, I think it's difficult for the students and the faculty to realize that the college is more than just the classroom situation. It is more than that. Why else would the college develop a beautiful campus? Why do we plant a tree on the campus? That's not going to help you learn any better. It contributes to the overall quality of life at the campus of William & Mary. And an athletic program that is not on a scale of something that you can be proud of, and this is probably where we get into the difference here, where you feel that a program where you are going to compete against Eastern Mennonite or Virginia Wesleyan or schools that are not of the national reputation that William & Mary has, would this is not going to draw those people back.
Okay.
If I can interject something a minute. Something about that bothers me just a bit. Just because the college does not play big-name football like UNC or Virginia or...
UNC and Virginia are not big-name football.
Whatever. Michigan State, anything. Why is that going to detract from the national educational reputation of the college? And Fairleigh Dickinson doesn't play big-name football. John Hopkins doesn't play.
It will not detract from the national reputation of William & Mary's academic stature. No, I never said that. I said what my feeling is that the loss of an athletic program, an intercollegiate athletic program, and I have to feel that policy program one would be the loss of an intercollegiate athletic program. I see no need for us to schedule Bridgewater if we're just looking for the opportunity for a student to participate in basketball. I see no need for us to schedule Bridgewater. Why not just schedule it between dorms? He would still have that opportunity to participate and enjoy. And we talk, there's a great deal of difference between participation and competition. Participation to me is going out in front of the dorm and throwing a football back and forth. Competition is getting a team together and seeing who can win. And to me, if you don't have competition, if you don't try and be the best at what you're trying to do, if you don't try and see how far you can develop your own skills, then you're not, you're just talking about exercise. there's a great deal of difference between the guy who goes out there and is exercising for health reasons and running around the block and the guy who wants to see how fast he can do it. You're talking about two different philosophies, and program one, I think, is being mistaken as a form of competition when all it is exercise.
I think, first, two things. I wonder how much exercise and how much competitiveness one feels when one sits in the football stands drinking daiquiris or drinking beer and calmly getting drunk, and the team's out there playing and you don't really know whether or not they're winning or, you know, and there's very little enthusiasm. The second point, a couple other points that I'd like to make, I think you've touched on a number of things that really concern students. And notice also in continuing that the Student Association supports Policy One. We're not referring to Program One, and I think there's a essential difference there. A couple other things that you mentioned. You said first that alumni would like to see a school with a national reputation. Now, you can gain that in a number of ways. You can gain it by playing big-time schools and losing because they're better than you are, or you can gain it by playing schools that are competitive, i.e., they are on your level, and you play good football against them, and you win, and you gain a reputation for winning, which I think is another form of national reputation. From what you've pointed out, it would seem to me that policy two, in not saying big time, is something that goes against what the alumni essentially want when they think of a team in terms of national reputation, because the thing that bothers me is that no matter if Notre Dame has a good football team or not, it has a tradition of being a good football school, and therefore we would want to play them. Whereas a school that's up and coming, you know, the one I've heard thrown around is Hampton City. Now, whether or not they will ever have a team that we should play competitively, I don't know. But take that, for example, which may not have a tradition, but may have a really fantastic team, would not be seen fit as a team that we should play in terms of the alumni's eyes because it does not have the tradition of playing good football. And I wonder, you know, whether that distinction is a valid one and whether it really points to policy too, or whether it just points to a fact that we may never be able to satisfy anybody. Another point that I'd like to make in terms of you talking of how much the Educational Foundation is giving, I believe the report quotes this, and I may be, you know, they may be wrong, but I have no other thing to refer to, is that the alumni gifts to the Educational Foundation represent only 9% of all alumni gifts to the college. Another thing that concerns me later on in the report is the fact that although this Educational Foundation and the alumni are extremely concerned about athletics at the college, that when the questionnaire, which was a standard questionnaire that was sent out last year, and which I've heard from both sides that it wasn't fair, so, you know, I figure that it's a pretty clear, pretty good questionnaire because it's equal flack on both sides, but that Educational Foundation only returned 4% of the number sent out, and the alumni only returned 1%.
Sharon,
and you notice that the two groups that responded the most were those which seemed to exhibit a great concern for the college, and those are the undergraduates and those are the faculty. So I really wonder how much interest these people supposedly have in the program itself. And it seems to me that given the compromise which the Student Association has hit upon, and I'm not saying it's going to solve everybody's problems because I don't think any compromise will, and I don't purport to be any Henry Clay in proposing it on behalf of the Student Association, but it seems to me that that compromise caters to the desire of the alumni to come back to the college and see a competitive team. It may not be a big-time team. It may not even be an ACC team, which may or may not be equated with big-time. But it's a team that can play a good game of football, and I think that's what they're interested in.
First of all, as far as the questionnaire, the great concern, you know, you hit upon the fact that people on both sides who wanted big time or wanted elimination, if you want to go to that extreme, or say program one or program two, which was not formulated at that time. The Educational Foundation members and the alumni felt that the questionnaire was impossible to express their views and had a total resentment to it and did not turn it in. People who were extremely close to the situation understood it very well, expressed to me that they could not fill it out and express their views properly. They were afraid that when it got sent into that giant computer that their expressions would not be interpreted properly, and that is a major reason why they were not returned.
Did they not reply in some other form, which is, I believe, the way the students did it, and with no particular pressure to reply? I noticed many students told me that they thought the survey was completely unfair, but they sent it back with notations on the bottom stating that it was unfair and for these particular reasons. And I noticed many people who were writing in significant amount of information besides the questions on the questionnaire because they were interested and they wanted their opinion to be heard.
Many Educational Foundation members did do that. When we're talking about many, I don't know how many you're talking about or how many I'm talking about. I'm just saying that the questionnaire was received by the alumni and the Educational Foundation members at a situation where they did not feel they could adequately express their opinions through it and did not return it, and that is why there is a poor return on that. We have had tremendous amount of letters come in the last 2 weeks. Now that the program is out and people have a chance to express themselves one way or the other, the volume of mail is something that I have never thought would be that strong or that emphatic or that volume as far as what the president has received and what I've received copies of people through the Educational Foundation. The interest is very widespread. The president made the comment that he has not seen a discussion as intellectually and stimulating and as wide range as this has occurred. I don't know his exact words, and maybe I shouldn't even quote him on the fact, but the impression was that this has caused a bigger stir than anything this campus has ever seen. And I think that is an indication of how widespread and how much interest there is. Sharon, could we turn really to the student, the Senate proposal, and discuss that?
The one thing that I would really like to concern myself with, I think, and what's important here is we're talking in terms of details. Maybe we ought to be talking in terms of the educational standards of the college and the way you, in terms of the athletic department and the alumni, see it, and the way the majority of students, as I've interpreted their points of view, which I think refers to a great extent in the proposal from the Student Association, and which the faculty, I believe, see the situation. And I, you know, in that respect, I'd like to particularly turn to that. I think it's something that has to be noted. If you'd like to go down point by point through the proposal, it's rather lengthy.
No, there's just we get into all sorts of problems with this entire report, whether you want to talk about philosophies, and then once you establish a philosophy, whether you can implement it in dollars and cents. For example, the Student Senate proposal that would basically, as I understand it, and maybe this is an oversimplification of it, would be to improve all our sports and drop back football to a 30-40 scholarship level. Yet it wants to drop football to 30 to 40 scholarships and still expects in its budget to have $175,000 worth of revenue, which is at the same level that we've had last year. And
it projects the feeling that students feel that they will go to the games because they want to see a competitive team and that the alumni in turn will come to those games.
Students aren't part of that $175,000 gate receipt.
This is in terms of the students feeling that the alumni are going to come back.
Well,
thing that is really characteristic about the issue that I think gives a poor perspective in terms of how many people actually would attend the games is if you will note that every football game that's at home this year is scheduled with another event. In terms of Parents' Day, in terms of homecoming, in terms of high school band day, in terms of Dad's Day, which is going to, now I'm not saying that's wrong, I think that football should be a part of those weekends, but at the same time I think it gives you a wrong perspective on in terms of how many people would come to the game for the virtue of the game itself.
Sharon, those activities are scheduled around a football game because they know that they have something that will draw a great many people to begin with. Those activities are dependent upon football to draw people back. You are expressing it exactly the opposite way.
We've just touched peripherally on this issue so far, but what relationship do you think the athletic program, either Policy 1, Policy 2, or the program that the college has now, what role does that play in relation to the college's academic reputation? Does the money spent on athletic activity detract from the money that could be spent to upgrade the educational standards of the college, or do you think that the national reputation, whatever that may be, gained by football is going to somehow make the college better academically?
When you talk about the money spent, you're talking about the student fee, because the college, under both of these proposals, spends none of its own money, either out of current fund local, which is money that the college has to expend on any area that they see fit, or state funds. None of those are in the intercollegiate athletic program. So we're talking about student money. Now, I don't see how the students could accept taking an $88 fee and saying we're going to no longer have athletics and your $88 is now going towards chemistry researches. I don't think the students would ever accept that unless, you know, you just said, well, we're going to increase tuition by $88 and telling the students we're going to improve the academic program at William & Mary, and we're just going to take something away that you did have and put that money into something else. So that's the only place the money is available. Anything that we're talking about in improving the football program, we're not talking about taking any state money, any college money. We're talking about taking $36. We're talking, as far as football is concerned, we're talking about taking $14 from every student, $14, which is half price of a season ticket, and adding to alumni contributions, Educational Foundation contributions, and gate receipts, and running a program that can be competitive and can improve dependent upon its own success. Now, as far as the value of that to a school, I think it improves the quality of life on campus as far as a social and cultural and, to a degree, educational ingredient of the campus life, as far as that day that you become an alumnus, you have some experiences other than the classroom to which relate your times at William & Mary. And I think that that is something that is very important and something that is, you know, a valued experience of your life on a college campus.
I think you're right in saying that there should be something else besides the classroom. I think William & Mary is a good example of how much it can provide outside of the classroom in terms of extracurricular activities. The thing that concerns me is we can still have an athletic program. Notice I'm not referring to program one. We can have an athletic program that will provide all these things at no expense to the student that he himself or she does not choose to pay. And I cannot see, you know, the dollars that you were talking about, again, and referring back to the breakdown of that fee, there's a lot more there than that, just that few, that little bit of money in terms of the ticket book. You also have the men's non-revenue sports that have to be paid for. The thing that I'd like to turn to particularly, though, is the fact that there's a feeling nationally, and this is from a report that I had read that I know the committee had also read and considered greatly, concerning a study on athletics across the country, and the feeling was that even when sports were cut out completely, which is not what I'm advocating, that very soon that the money coming into the college had from donations had risen back to its normal standard. My point here is that if we go to a humongous program, and even though people may be giving more money, which, you know, I'm not really sure is going to happen, that because of financial austerity of the country as a whole, because of inflation, the people don't have as much money to give, so if they give to athletics, they're not going to give to academics, and that's going to hurt the problem there. It may, in a sense, draw those funds away. The point that I particularly like to get to, though, is when you turn to the figures, and this was gotten from the business office, the amount of grants that have been given to athletes at present is $308,000. That, to, as far as academic grants and aids, is $219,000. I think you see a disparity there.
Where did the funds come from, though, Sharon? Okay. The $308,000 came from contributions solely for those athletic scholarships and from gate receipts from football and basketball games. That money would not be available for anything else.
Okay, fine. I agree with you. If that's what we're going to project, which is what I think the Student Association program says, fine. But what this program talks about is taking money out of student fees. Now, I see that...
For scholarships?
In men's non-revenue.
Men's non-revenue,
okay.
which is about $20,000. $36,000, the total amount that non-revenue sports have right now,
And the Educational Foundation has agreed to absorb at least $15,000 of that next year. So you're talking about $21,000.
Let me conclude my point, though. My point is, though, that students will have to pay for other students, at least for a period of time. The thing that really bothers us is the fact that the standards may not be maintained in admittance to the college. And this, I think, is a crucial point, and one which upsets the largest number of people who are turned off by policy, too. And that's that the standards may have to be lowered. Now, it was pointed out to me yesterday by the admissions office that the procedure towards admissions had been changed in the past 2 weeks, such that it is now across the board qualifications for everyone, which in the past there was a variance in that athletic transcripts were taken out and reviewed particularly, and the range in which they were admitted to the college was much broader. Now, you may say, well, those people are still qualified and they didn't fall into the lower range, into the reject area, and were admitted simply because of their athletic ability. But from a study that was taken by a sociology student last year, he found, in dealing with the admissions office and talking to a number of athletes and getting their figures, that the athletes' average board scores were 142 points on the whole perspective, below the mean of everyone else at the college. And it seems to me that there's the problem with, given the shortage of housing on campus, given the number of people who apply, that the fact that you're admitting somebody who is not as academically qualified places immense pressures on that person, outside of the fact that it also takes up the space that somebody who is more academically qualified cannot fill.
Let me answer a couple of those things very quickly, because I guess we're running out of time. But obviously, if there is a top student who is admitted who has 1,600 on the board scores, everyone is some amount of points below that person. The point is that although the athlete who has been admitted within the broad range of admittable people to the college in the last 2 years, no football player has flunked out. No football player has failed to get his degree in the allotted amount of time. Only one track athlete in the last 5 years has failed academically from this school. And so although they may be slightly less qualified than the average to enter, his performance has been better.
I think that those figures are somewhat misleading in knowing some of those athletes personally, in turning not only to football but to the basketball team, which has had a problem in keeping athletes in school. I think that you also have to consider the type of preferential treatment that is given in terms of registration, in terms of course allotments.
They have had no preferential treatment in the last 2 years.
From what I understand, there is special tutoring that is given to athletes. And I think there are a number of things that have to be considered in that whole thing. Now, I think it's essentially unfair that if we're going to maintain our academic excellence, which is what the alumni, I think, would want. You said that your degree means a lot more to you now, and that has to deal with the college. I think you're dealing with that academically. That if we want to maintain a good program in terms of athletics, in terms of a competitive program, then we can do that given the number of people who want to come to college, given the large market, by still maintaining our standards and still, you know, if we have to give some grants and aids, then practically we may have to do it. And I think that's where we have an extremely reasonable approach.
Sharon, is the existing admissions policy acceptable to the students?
The policy at present, which is after having been changed, so it's straight across the board now, is acceptable to the students.
Now,
if you're referring to a policy that up until 2 weeks ago existed, then I don't think it would be acceptable.
The policy hasn't changed. The procedures have changed.
This
policy and the procedure as it currently exists is acceptable to the William Murray coaches as something that they can build strong teams under proposal two, as articulated to the president yesterday.
Okay, thank you. Our guests on Information Point have been Sharon Pandak, the president of the William & Mary Student Association, and Barry Fratkin, the sports promotion director at the college. Our topic, the role of athletics at William & Mary. The Board of Visitors of the college will receive the report of the Athletic Study Committee next Friday for consideration and eventual decision on which direction the college will take in sports. For Information Point, this is Brian Costello.